All right, we'll be talking about Section 11 today on queues, starting here on slide 2. A queue, just like a stack, is a restricted list structure. Except where a stack is a one-tailed list structure, a queue is a two-tailed list structure. Basically, it's a FIFO, it's usually what's referred to as a FIFO structure, first in, first out. You've been queuing up all your life, even though you didn't know it. A line, if you get into for a service, is a queue. You enter into the rear of the line, unless you're really big and have a club, and you wait until you get to the front of the line in order to get service, and you dequeue. You enqueue at the rear of the line, you dequeue at the front of the line. The operations here are typical operations similar to the stack operations. We have a constructor empty full operations and an insert operation, which is NQ, and a DQ operation there, which is a delete operation, which is the DQ operation. Now, Some implementations, just like sort of the stack is a top operation, some implementations of queue will have a front operation in the structure, and the front just returns a copy of the front element but doesn't actually delete it from the queue. And in that case, usually DQ doesn't return the element but just deletes it. So, let's first look, we'll do what we've been doing previously on data structures. We'll talk about an application. We've talked about it in the abstract sense. Now we'll talk about applying it, and then we'll talk about implementing it. So here on slide 3 is the discussion of a little fictional operating system. Back before everybody had their own machine and we had to share big mainframes, in the early days, they were only batch operating systems, where a user would submit their job to get it executed. And typical operating systems used what's called a multi-level feedback queuing system, where they had a number of queues, and they had basically one queue for each sort of level of user ID. And in this little fictional system here, we've got 9 levels. The user ID numbers are in the hundreds ranges, and 100 to 199 would be user, they're at user level 1, they're the highest, 900 to 999 is the lowest. Now, within each of these priority groups, within each of these levels, the jobs, the processes, the programs they submit to execute, they have to get submitted, they get executed in a first-in, first-out structure, okay, and in order, they queue up in order for a fair execution to take place. If there is a highest priority job queued, it'll get executed before any other job, and so on and so on down the line. The system maintains an array of queues. So in this case, if we have max levels here being 9, we can define a type, a MLFQS, multi-level feedback queuing system type, to be an array of queues. And then we can instantiate that array of queues, and we'll call it job. And that'll hold the job information. Now, here's what, on slide 4, what this thing sort of looks like in terms of the topology. We have a dispatcher program, which is a program that receives your program that you want it executed. And it looks at your user ID in order to figure out which of these priority levels to put your job at for execution. There's a dispatcher, or a job scheduler program, which runs, the operating system runs to get the next high, to get the next job to execute in order to let the CPU work on this next job. Now, our queue type, that item type, would have to hold this sort of information. Typical in operating system terminology, this is usually referred to as the PCB, the process control block. It contains stuff like the user ID, process ID, priority, state information, pointers for the memory information of the system, register save area, a bunch of other stuff. We aren't going to really concern ourselves with that information. So, here on slide 5, it discusses this system a little bit. Given that we can use any of those standard Q operations, NQ, DQ, etc., what if our task was to write a procedure called add job, or the dispatcher basically, that receives a user ID and a token, that the token has the information on the job or the program to be executed, and it adds it to the appropriate queue for the user's priority level. Now how would you write add job? Add job would get it would receive the jobs array, the array of queues, and it would receive this token that represents the job to be executed and the user ID. What would it do? It's really quite simple. What would it do? If that user ID is in the range from 100 to 999, what would you do? You would divide that by what in order to figure out their priority level? Divide it by 100. Okay? You divide it by 100. That gives you a number from 1 through 9. Now you have to then subtract 1 from that. Why? To get the array index, because array index to start at 0, right? And then what would we do? Then we would just do what? Enqueue it into that particular queue, right? We would say job sub whatever that calculation is dot enqueue token. Okay? We would call the enqueue function on that particular queue. Now, to be safe, we really should probably first check to see if that queue is full, right? We would really want to first check to make sure that queue was not full. If that queue was full, what would we do? What do you think we should do? What would be a reasonable thing to do? Huh? Tell them that they can't run. Tough luck. Sorry, buddy. Call me back later and I'll think about it. Well, you could do that. That's not really very nice. We can design a little bit more intelligence into the operating system, can't we?
Stick them on the next level, possibly the next level.
Yeah, we'd probably stick them on the next level. Not the next highest level, but probably the next lowest level. But then we have to be a little careful, because what if it's also full? What we really need to do at that point is to do a little for loop. We do a little for loop from the index level that we calculated, plus 1, but while that's less than the max level queues, and we would keep on going. And while that's less than the max level queues, and Q sub I, if that's the for index, dot, not empty, right? If it's not full, right? As long as it is full. Well, that one's full. And then we just do I plus plus. And then the body of that for statement is null, right? Because all it needs to do is just loop around until it finds one. And then we check when we get out of that to check to see if the one we found was full or not. And if it wasn't, we go ahead and enqueue. And if it is, it means we got to the bottom and all of the lower ones are full. And at that point, we don't have any choice. We've got to send them a message back saying, tough luck, try again. Okay? So that would basically be the add job. Now here's you should be able to write little functions like that on your own. Okay? It's not that tough to do. You have to think about how queues work, how stacks work. If I tell you to assume that they're already implemented and I describe a problem like this for you, you should be able to sort of talk your way through and code up a small little function like this. I'll let you try get next job, which is the job scheduler. You can try that over the next day or two if you want to get some practice at this, and then you can come in and ask me questions about it on class on Thursday at the start of class. We'll go ahead and do a more complicated one right now, though. We'll talk our way through a couple of them. Here's one. The system is going down for maintenance. All jobs waiting for execution will be purged, that means killed, from the jobs. This is a very user-friendly system that notifies users when their jobs are being murdered, and so that they'll know to resubmit their jobs later. And so there's this procedure, notify, function notify, which takes a token and a message ID, and it takes care of the notification. It figures out, how to send the message across the network, where the user is at, on what terminal or whatever. We don't have to worry about that. That can get to be obviously quite detailed. But we want to write a procedure, cleanup job, that sends message 7 to all of the users with queued jobs, sending them to the highest priority users first. What would that function look like? How would you write that function? That function would take the array of jobs, and that's it, right? It would take the array of jobs, the array of queues, and how would you write that function? Who besides me can write that function? How would you go through each one?
A for loop?
Ah, for loop within the other for loop. You're right. The outer for loop would loop from where to where?
From the beginning to the end.
From 0 to as long as it's less than the maximum levels of queues, right. And the inner for loop then?
Wow,
does it need to be a for loop? The inner loop, does it need to be a for loop?
Right.
It'd actually be better if it was a while, right?
While the
queue's not empty, you just dequeue it, and then you call notify, and that's it. So you've got a for loop to go to drive your code through all of the array of queues, through the array, and then you've got a while loop that empties out each of the queues. Questions? Everybody follow that logic? You could write that on a test if I gave it to you. Good. Alright, so what? Do you have what?
Set queue to be empty.
Set queue to be empty. That is the constructor.
Oh.
Okay? Right. Okay. So yes, you have it, but you better not be invoking it to set the queue to be empty. Okay? You got to do that by going through it and dequeue it. And there's also going to be if there's a constructor, there should be a destructor, okay? But and while you could sort of call that destructor explicitly, that wouldn't give you a chance to really notify each user. All right, so here's a little variation. That kind of a multi-level feedback queuing system that I just explained to you was we found out, of course, to have what's called a very poor throughput average. Throughput, in terms of an operating system, is the number of jobs, the number of processes that the operating system executes in a given amount of time. And in each given amount of time, one of the things you'd like to do is have the operating system be able to execute as many jobs as possible so that you achieve a high throughput to keep the efficiency of the operating system at a high level. Well, the problem with a multi-level feedback batch operating system is that when somebody like Dr. Ribbons, who submits these large compute-bound ill-conditioned, enormous matrix partial differential equations that he's trying to solve out in Euclidean dimensional space, trying to find this intersection of all of these Euclidean hyperplanes, which is really pretty complex. These big compute-bound jobs just get a hold of the CPU and they won't let it go. They will suck it up. Okay? And unfortunately, that means that every user below them, even though they might have some small piddling job that would just take a fraction of a second to run, they're out of luck. They got to wait for the 15, 20, 50 minutes or whatever, a few hours, until Ribbon's hogging job can finish up. And so one way around that, they realized early on, was to implement what's called time sharing in operating systems, where you don't let, once a job is allocated to the CPU, you don't let it just keep the CPU until it finishes. What you do is you give it a time slice to execute in. You give it a small time slice, which is really a fraction of a second. How big that time slice is that you give it depends upon the processor. Over in the computing center, there's a large IBM supercomputer over there where 1,000 users from around the university can be logged on to that thing at the same time. and it's running 1,000 or more processes at the same time. Now, in order to make each of these users think that they have the to get a readable feedback, what it does is it only gives their job a fraction of a second, basically about 1,000th of a second. What it does then is it takes a job, it executes it for 1,000th of a second, it enqueues it back, takes another job, executes it for 1,000th of a second, takes it back, and the processor is so fast that in that 1,000th of a second, it can execute millions of instructions for their program. And so as far as the user's concerned, they can't type fast enough to keep up with the with that processor. And as far as they're concerned, they have their own, to them, they have their own little personal computer running just as fast as any others. So the idea of having this number of time slices means that we let a program execute for a time slice, we increase a count of the number of time slices it's received, and then we go on to the next job. Well, the problem is you still run into this hogging problem. Questions?
Do you ever find yourself thinking about the supercomputers in terms of algorithms?
No. I'll salivate over a sports car maybe, but not a supercomputer. Or maybe a 56 Ford truck. No, never mind. You still have this hogging job though problem. Except now it's actually even more heinous. Because what happens is that a job like Dr. Ribbon's big compute bound job gets in here, all of the small jobs that are at that level, they will get they'll get completed pretty quick. But what will happen is his job will be the only one left in at this highest level, and the system will spend its time taking his job off, executing it for a time slice, putting it back on the queue, taking it right back off of the queue, executing it for a time slice, and putting it back on. And so basically now the work, part of the work that the system will be doing will be wasted because it'll be spending some of its time taking this thing on and off, on and off, on and off. And that's just wasted time that it could be executing programs. So what we need is a function that the operating system can call whenever necessary, whenever its statistics code determines that the throughput has dropped below a certain threshold. And it will call this function called a just priority that'll move the hogging job down to the next lowest priority queue. And we'll define a hogging job as some program that's received some greater than hog number of time slices, where that's a system constant. So here's the code for this function, that just priority here on slide 6. It takes the jobs array of queues, and it has some Boolean error flag. And basically what it does here is first it goes through and it finds the highest, current highest queue with jobs. So while we haven't found that queue and our queue counter is less than max level minus 1, if that's not empty, then we found one and we'll set found to true and stop the while loop. Otherwise, we'll just bump up the queue and look at the next one and keep going. When we come out of that loop, we'll check the system. There's an error here if we haven't found a level with jobs in it. And we actually stop. Notice Q is stopping at max levels minus 1. Because if we reach the lowest level, we can't move jobs down any lower than that, right? So if we don't find one above that lowest level that has jobs in it, this function can't do anything. So we'll check. If that's not an error, if we did find a higher level queue with jobs in it, then what we'll do is while that queue, jobs of queue dot empty, while that's not empty, we'll go through, we will dequeue the first job off of that. We'll call it like its get time function so that we find out the number of time slices it's received. And we'll check to see if that's greater than this hog system constant. And if it is, then we will enqueue it onto the next lowest queue. We'll enqueue it onto Q plus jobs to Q plus 1. Otherwise, we'll enqueue it onto a temporary queue. And we'll keep going through here. This while loop will keep going until that queue is empty. Once that queue is empty, then we have to, it's possible that when this adjust priority function is called, all of those jobs that's on that highest level priority queue may not be holding jobs. Some of them might have been small jobs that just arrived right before this function got called, and they haven't received many time slices yet. So in that case, we have to restore those to the same queue. So while they're temporary queue, and which I defined up there, I just instantiated another temporary queue object, and it just comes into being. It initializes itself, and I can use it. And so here then, I'll dequeue from the temporary queue and enqueue back onto the job sub queue. Okay? Now there is one line of code in that function that is a bit risky. It's just a little risky that I should have probably, if I was really being careful and checking for things, I should have checked for something else. Which line is it? You act like you know which one. That's right. Well, I say job q plus 1 dot nq because I better check to see if that next lowest queue has enough space, right? If it's not full before I just try and stick one on it. Otherwise the system could blow up. That's why operating systems, little logic errors like this at times, that's why operating systems sometimes just sort of lock up on you. Okay? Alright. So, there's an example of using queues. Now let's talk about implementing queues. We'll talk about sequential queue implementation first here on slide 11.7. We could use a linear array. If we use a linear array, then we have to let maybe the beginning of the array be the front and let the rear float or vice versa. And the problem with that is that when we would dequeue items, we'd have to shift elements in the array. And that's pretty inefficient. Okay? So you never really want to implement a queue as a linear array. What you really want to implement a queue as is using a circular array. If you're going to do a sequential queue implementation, do it as a circular array. Now in reality, there is no such creature as a circular array in programming. Right? But what we can do is we can make a regular queue behave as though it's circular. We can index it so that when we get to the end and we add one, we get back to the beginning. And as long as we do that, it'll logically be a circular area of memory, even though physically it's not a circular area of memory. We can use it as though it's a circular area of memory. So, if we do that, then if we could set this up, in order to do that, all we would have to do is anytime that we increment these indexes, like front and rear, when we add one to them, we would just mod it by whatever the size of our queue array is, like max queue. That would mean if we define our queue dimension to be max queue, that means its indexes go from 0 to max queue minus 1. And if we mod every index by max queue, we'll be getting the remainder, and we'll always have integers in the range from 0 to max queue minus 1. When we're at max queue minus 1, and you add 1 to that and then mod it by max queue, what do you get?
Yeah.
0. Okay? So, if we were doing this, then we could set this up so that the front and rear indexes delimit the bounds of the queue. That would mean then that front is going to chase the rear index around this array. And when we enqueue an item, we'll add one to q.rear and insert the item there. When we dequeue one, we'll return the item as q front, and then we'll add one to front, mod it, and so front will chase rear around this array. And we won't ever have to worry about shifting any of the array elements when we enqueue or dequeue. So so we avoid that memory copying, which is quite inefficient. So, if we do this this way, we have to actually maintain a cue count to make sure that we know how many elements are in the array. This would be a one element cue here when cue dot front and cue dot rear are pointing to the same element. And then if we add another one to rear, we would add one to rear and insert the element there. The problem would be then if we keep doing that, we run into a bit of a problem. This here, where rear is one behind front, is that an empty or a full cue? If a one element cue is where rear and front are both at the same index, then we would need this to be an empty cue. So that when we insert the first item, we would add one to rear and insert the item, they both be at the same index. But if rear is one behind front, if we keep enqueuing and enqueuing and enqueuing, what happens when it's full? Rear is one behind front. So we don't have any way of checking for these two distinct states in the queue unless we maintain a queue count. Well, we can avoid maintaining the queue count with kind of a classic programming technique. And it's basically a trade-off technique. We're going to sacrifice memory so that we don't have to do some extra processing. Okay? This is a classic trade-off. Used to be that we did this trade-off in reverse. Many years ago, when computer memories were very small, okay, remember how I told you, I made everyone laugh when I told you the first computer I ever programmed on had 4K, and that was it. That was its RAM, okay? 4K. When you programmed on something like that, you had to do tricks. You would do a lot of extra processing to save memory because you just didn't have the memory. You couldn't. You'd have to wait for the machine to do a bunch of extra work at times just to save yourself a few bytes here and there. But nowadays, we do the trade-off in the opposite direction with the large primary memories that we have. And the way we do this trade-off is that we design our implementation so that these states of the queue are represented distinctly. And the way that we do this is by we don't let front actually refer or point to the index of the actual front element. Front will actually be one position behind the front element. Now you have to think about this because intuitively this doesn't really leap out at you as being a solution for this problem. There's, at least to me it doesn't. Okay, I had to think about this the first time I saw it because it's just not something that you would do intuitively. But it does work. And what happens then if front, with front being one position preceding the actual front element, that would mean that this would be a full queue here when rear is one behind front. What would be an empty queue? Well, an empty queue would be when queue dot rear is equal to queue dot front. That would be an empty queue. And what about a one element queue? Well, we would add one to rear and enqueue the element. That would be when queue dot rear is one in front of the front element. And that gives us three distinct representations for each of those different states of the queue. And we can use those to basically save having to maintain this queue count. And here's the checks for each of those distinct states. And they're all different checks, as you can see. Here, if Q dot rear plus 1 mod max Q equals Q dot front, then it's full. We know that rear is 1 behind front. If they're both equal, we know it's empty. And if front plus 1 mod max Q is equal to rear, we know front is 1 behind rear, and rear is pointing to the last element in the queue. Front is one element, is one preceding the first element, so we know there's only one element in the queue. That's the way we do this. And it gives us a very efficient implementation. So, here would be, on this next slide, 11.9, here would be the implementation of this. Here's the array representation. We've got our item submax Q, our array of item, and we have our empty full NQ, DQ operations here. The Q interface doesn't really change no matter what underlying representation we're going to use. And you just have to remember when you're doing something like this, when you're implementing a data structure, a data type like this, that you have to establish some conventions for the representation of the state of your structure. And you just have to be consistent with those conventions that you decide on when you're doing your coding. It's all up to you, and as long as you're consistent, there won't be any logic problems. The one thing to note with this type of implementation, the dequeued items don't really get removed from the queue when they're dequeued. When we dequeue one, we'll add one to front, mod it of course, and then we'll return that element. But the element will still physically be in the queue. And it'll be in the queue and remain in the queue until rear comes back around and stores back over top of it. Okay? So we won't bother to take it out. Now, you have to be a little bit, now, not taking that element out of the queue and leaving it in the queue is actually one way that an operating system could almost sort of be broken if you're not careful. Think about an operating system doing this. If an operating system is maintaining information about their users, like their passwords and stuff, in a queue of information, and as users log on and log off, and they enqueue and dequeue users from the queue, well, what happens if another program comes around and just starts going through memory and printing out the contents of memory? That user's left, but now their information is still in memory. Okay? And you might say, well, an operating system wouldn't let a program have access to its memory. Well, what if the operating system is really just a collection of programs that shares memory too. So part of the operating system could come into a section of primary memory, execute, then get taken out. Another job could come in, another job, a user's job could come into that memory and have legal access to that memory. And a user, a sneaky user, could just write an application that goes through this memory and prints out what was left there. Or better yet, just goes through and searches it for certain keywords like password. Okay? It might be a security issue, leaving information like that around for the type of application you're working on. If you're needing to write a real secure application, that might not be a valid thing to do. It might be better to actually wipe that information out as you take it out, as you dequeue it from the queue. Zero it out. Even if it's encrypted, you might want to zero it out, because encryption schemes can still be broken. Just a thought. You saw that I put up that announcement about the PKI security talk that's going to be going on Thursday. Those are the types of things that security people really have to sort of have to think about and take under consideration. So here's the operation implementation here on slide 11.10. The constructor just sets front and rear equal to zero. That makes it empty because they're both pointing to the same element. Empty just checks to see if they're equal. Full checks to see if rear plus one mod max Q is equal to front, if rear is one behind front. Now, to enqueue an element, we add one to rear and mod it, and then we just insert the item there. For DQ, we add one to front, we move front first, and then we return the item that's at that position in the array. Now, if you recall, when we talked about stacks, there was the possibility of an error in a stack occurring. What was it called when you would push too many elements or try to pop too many elements? Stack. Overflow or underflow. Same thing can happen with the queue. Now, I'm not checking for that here. It's possible that if a user calls in queue and this queue is full, that in queue function is going to blow up. And the DQ function here doesn't check to see if the queue is empty before it tries to return an element. So it might blow up, or it might return garbage. And most likely it would be returning both of them would be returning garbage in this case, because when you instantiate a queue and the array gets instantiated, the items, the item objects, the item type, which is the type of the array, if that's a class, and it would be better if it is a class, if it's a class, it would have to have a default constructor, and its default constructor would immediately initialize every element location in the array to some dummy value of item, whatever you're storing in the queue. So these would probably just be returning those dummy items at that point. Or they might be returning items that they previously returned if things get screwed up. So there's the question here of should these functions be checking for queue overflow or underflow or not? Well, I've chosen not to here. Why? I've taken the efficiency approach. I have provided a full and an empty function to my users of this queue class. And they can check. I provided for them a mechanism to check to see if the queue is full or empty. So if they think that there's a possibility that they might actually be trying to do an in queue onto a full queue or a DQ onto an empty queue, they can check first. And it's up to them to do so. If they don't, they run the risk that this blows up. And I'd have to spell that out in my documentation for them very clearly. And I think that's a more reasonable approach to take, because most, if I included checks for that in both of these operations, that extra checking code would hardly ever really be, it would hardly ever really detect queue overflow or underflow. It really wouldn't detect it. It really wouldn't detect it hardly at all. And it would be up to the, and I really wouldn't know when it would be best to check for it and when it wouldn't. That's dependent upon the application. That's dependent upon the user's code. They're the ones that are best to check for that. So I'm leaving that up to them to do so. Okay. Well, let's talk about another implementation of queues. What about a linked list representation? Rather than representing a queue as a circular array, if we've already coded up a linked list class, and we said that a queue is nothing more than a restricted form of a list, then we can go ahead and just implement it using our linked list code. The front will point to the head of the list, the rear will point to the end of the list or the last node. The in queue will operate upon the rear pointer, always inserting after the last node, and the DQ will operate upon the front pointer, always removing the head of the list. And the empty queue would just be null front and rear pointers. So, here is our queue interface. Here's our queue interface doing this. We have a queue linked list object that's inside of each of our queue objects. This is what's known as class aggregation. We are aggregating one object inside of another object. Whenever we instantiate a queue object, the constructor for the aggregated object will automatically execute and initialize the linked list in this case. To a certain extent, we don't really need a queue constructor because the language will supply us a default constructor, and that default, the only thing that default constructor will do, which is all we need it to do, will be it will automatically invoke the linked list constructor. And we don't really need a destructor because the linked list destructor will take care of cleaning up the memory for us. And the rest of this, the rest of the interface, empty, full, in queue, DQ, that really hasn't changed. We don't change that. That way, if we don't change that interface, we could actually take a program, we could take code that was written using one queue underlying representation, and we could pull out maybe a circular array implementation. We could plug in a linked list representation, and the queue should still work without any problem whatsoever. Right? Reusability. Now, to implement this, here's the code on slide 1112 that does this. The queue empty operation just returns whether the list is empty. It invokes the list is empty function. If it's full, well, here we have to allocate a new node and check to see whether there was memory allocated to do so. And if there was, then we would, if there isn't, if we get back a null pointer, we return true. Otherwise, we can delete that node that we just allocated and return false. We know there is more memory to be used. For enqueuing, we want to enqueue on the rear. So what we do is we tell the queue to go to its tail so that it'll move the current pointer to the end of the list, the rear of the list, and then we'll tell it to insert after that. So we'll use the queue, we'll use the list insert function. And for dequeuing, we tell the queue to go to the head to make the first element in the queue, in the list, the current element, and then we will get the data that's there and store that temporarily, and then we'll tell that list to delete the current node, which will delete the head node, and then we'll return that return the item that we just removed from the list, and that's it. We don't have to do any more coding. We basically just substitute in calls to our linked list. Okay. Now, let's talk about a couple little variations of stacks and queues. This first one is one, you won't find it in any textbooks, I don't think, because I dreamed it up myself one day. I was sitting around one day, I was reading through the user manual for an editor. It was a really pretty boring day, as you might guess. And the only reason I was looking at the user's manual because I'd noticed that the editor had a couple of what I would call strange behaviors. Its undo function, for example, would sort of stop working after a while at times. And I wondered why. And I found out that in their documentation, they said their undo function only had 10 levels of undo. It would remember the last 10 operations. And I thought, well, now that's kind of strange. That means then that whenever if I do 10 operations, and then I do an 11th operation, that would mean it would forget the first operation that I had done. And I could undo the last 10. And I thought, wonder what kind of data structure they're using to do that. And the thing that came to my mind was what I called a dropout stack, or a short for DOS, for dead operating system. Okay? Get it, DOS, dead op, never mind. There would be no full stack operation on this. But the way this thing would behave, if it holds, let's say, 5 elements, and we push 5 elements of whatever onto this, then the stack would sort of be full. And then if we push a 6th element, it would sort of push the bottom one, the bottom of this stack would sort of open up, this one would drop through, and the stack would close, and this one would just sort of drop out into non-existence. And we would lose it. And that's the way its behavior would appear to work logically. Well, if we think about implementing this type of a stack, we could think of using a linear array, but the problem with that is no matter where we put the bottom or the top of the stack, we'd have to do shifting whenever dropouts occur. And we know we don't want to do shifting because memory copying is pretty expensive. So the simple solution is just to use a circular array. We can use a circular array here. We could use a size counter if we only used one element or one index like the top, but we can avoid using that size count by once again storing both the top and the bottom. And in this case, the bottom index will take the top index around. As we push things on to here, and then as we push things on, and then we pop things off, this will happen. The top will go back and then forward. The problem, of course, would be when we need a dropout to occur. The top would have to come over here. We'd have to check to see if the next one is the bottom. Before we do a push, we have to check to see if the next position that we're getting ready to push an element into is where the bottom is at. And if it is, we would actually need to move the bottom one so that we could store over top of it. And that'll cause us to really, that'll cause the bottom one to logically drop out. Now, we do have the problem of having to make sure that we have distinct representations for each of the unique states of this structure. And we can use the same trick we did for a circular array. We can let the bottom here not actually refer to be the index of where the bottom of the stack is stored at, but it'll be one before it. And if it's one before it, then we end up with unique representations for an empty stack, a one-element stack, and a full stack. And they're the same representations that you end up with a circular cube. Okay? So the implementations, as you might imagine, all of the code is almost identical to that code that's in a circular cube implementation. Now, Here is a variation of a cube on slide 1115, which you will find in a lot of data structures books. It's called a deck. Even though it looks like it's pronounced DQ, it's pronounced deck. Now, it's kind of like that old Monty Python skit where the guy's doing a talk show, and he goes, "I'd like to introduce my next guest, Thorn Whoppler Mangrove." And the guy comes out and says, no, my name is spelled Thorn Whoppler Mangrove, but it's pronounced John Smith. And he looks at him and says, "You're a very silly man, and I'm not going to talk to you." Never mind, you have to have been there. Surely everybody watched Monty Python, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. If you haven't, go watch it. Great idiocy. So, for a double-ended queue, the only difference between that and a regular queue is that we can do operations on both the front and the rear. We can, not only can we dequeue from the front, but we can also enqueue to the front. And not only can we enqueue to the rear, but we can also dequeue to the rear. So we have these operations here. Now, we don't bother to use a linear array because otherwise we have memory copying that goes on when we have to do shifting. So we use a circular array, and once again we'll let front refer to one position preceding the actual front element so that we can maintain all of those unique states. There's a slight problem with this, and that would be that when we want to enqueue to the front, we would need to be able to actually insert the elements where the front one is at, and then subtract one from the front. Or whenever we're dequeuing from the rear, we would want to return this element that's at the rear, and then we would want to subtract one from the rear. We now want the index to move backwards. How would we do that? Give me the code to do that. Would it be rear minus one? Would it just be rear minus one or front minus one? What would be the problem of just saying rear minus one or front minus one? If the index is zero, what do I end up with? Negative one. And is that a valid array index? No. So can I subtract one? Do I have to subtract one and mod it by max q? So if I'm at zero and I subtract one and I mod it by max q, let's say our array is a size 100. Max q is a size 100. And I'm at zero. And so I subtract 1 from it and mod it by 100. What do I get?
Negative 1.
Really, you don't know. It turns out, if you read the language standard, I think it says that the operation of modulo arithmetic upon negative numbers is undefined. Yes, you did, didn't you? And some of us haven't forgotten our lessons from those classes many years ago. So how do we do this safely? We do it safely by using complement notation. Now, what's complement notation? Complement arithmetic. You've learned what complement arithmetic is, right? In 1104, haven't y'all studied complements yet? Huh? Is that a yes or a no? Let me see if I can do this real quick. I need a blackboard. I probably won't need chalk. Yeah, here it is. Just hold on. I'm going to show you how you do this. You can use complement in any base. You've probably studied complement in base in binary. Now that's an erasure. You can use complements, however, in any base. For example, if we have 100, if this is our base, if this is our max Q, this is our constant for the size of the array. What I really want is, let's say for example I have a problem of, this is a circular system that we're in. Well now, if I say something like, let's say, 37 minus 49. Okay. Now 47, let me reverse that. Let's say 49 minus 37. Now 49 minus 37 should give me 12, right? Well, the negative 37 is the additive inverse of 37, right? If I add these, I get 0. Well, it turns out that the property of additive inverses is just that. It's a number such that when you add it to that number, you get 0. Well, there's another number in this system that ends up being the additive inverse for 37. And that number is 63. 63 plus 37 is what? Huh? It's 100, but in this system, we have no 100. When we count to 100, we go back to 0, right? So 37 plus 63 is 0. Now, if this is accurate, then the result of adding 49 plus the inverse of 37 should be the same as subtracting 37. So if I add 49 and 63, what do I get? 12. Okay? So, in this case, I want to be able, in order to move these things backwards safely, I want to be able to subtract one. What I really need is the additive inverse of one. What number added to one in this system will give me 0? 99, which is the base minus 1. That'll actually end up giving me 0. So that would mean in order to move something backwards in this system, if I'm at position, let's say, 53, and I want to actually subtract 1, what I add to this is max Q minus 1 mod max Q. So that would be what? That would be 53 plus 99, which is 152, and then mod that by max Q, and what do I get? 52. The same as if I had subtracted 1. And now if I'm at zero, if I'm at zero in the position, if my front or rear index is zero, and I want to subtract one, I do what? I add the modulus minus one and mod it, and the result will be 99. Okay? That's the way you safely subtract one in a modulo base. You add the base minus one, which is the complement of one in the system. Okay, we're going to start talking about algorithm analysis on Thursday.